When it comes to physical pain, most of us hate to experience it ourselves, which may be one reason we frown on violence. Because we know what it feels like to hurt, we try to avoid injuring other people unless our very survival is at stake. But one form of emotional pain is different. We can barely stand the way shame makes us feel, but we sometimes enjoy witnessing some other person get taken down a peg. And when somebody's humiliation is playing out online, many people gleefully pile on for a dose of dopamine-boosting righteous indignation, secure in the knowledge that performing our outrage on social media is unlikely to cost us anything at all. Is this really the kind of morality we want to practice? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There is a huge difference between punching up when participating in shame, taking aim at those who abuse their power, for example, and punching down, the mean-spirited humiliation of regular people without any evidence that they deserve their comeuppance. Like, have you seen that People of Walmart meme? It's pictures of real people just trying to go about their lives, including an obese woman whose motorized cart tipped over while she was reaching for a case of soda about 10 years ago. The person who snapped and posted her photo and the thousands of others who shared it to ridicule her, they didn't know her. They didn't know that she suffered from a painful spinal disease. But empathy requires time and attention, whereas turning a cruel joke viral requires only a click of the mouse and a willingness to overlook someone's humanity. Author Kathy O'Neill is a contributor to Bloomberg Opinion. She launched the LEAD program for data journalism at Columbia University and recently founded Orca, an algorithm auditing company. Her book is called The Shame Machine: Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation? Kathy, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Shame does have a social function to an extent. How does it work to enforce cultural and behavioral norms?
Yeah, it's a really important point. And I want to make it clear from the outset that shame is a really important and crucial tool for social cohesion. Shame is basically the thing that makes you behave well towards a group versus just for yourself. It often sparks a conflict between what you want and what the group wants. So a great example of that might be in a time of famine, you might want to hoard food, but it would be shameful to do so because other people might be starving. So the fact that shame exists to enforce social norms, to keep the community healthy and safe, is really, really crucial at those moments. And moreover, it also explains why shame hurts so much. Shame hurts because it threatens our sense of self. It threatens our sense of being lovable. And so when we are shamed successfully, when it really lands on us, it really makes us afraid. It makes us feel existentially threatened, like we could, in fact, be shunned entirely, thrown out of the community, and die of exposure, potentially. And that is how it evolved as an important tool in our survival.
The phenomenon you're critiquing in this book is something you call the shame industrial complex. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it's my observation that shame has been weaponized. So the same sort of reaction that we have, that like we feel unlovable and we must make things right, which historically means like we must share our food, has been turned against us. So we are shamed for profit, we are shamed for power, and we are in fact coaxed and conditioned to shame each other for entertainment. And those are all things that that aren't historically the uses of shame. So I argue in the book that the sort of industries that make money or maintain power from us and from our shame reactions have hijacked a natural impulse to work against us.
And shame now is often used to make us feel terrible about things we have little control over, including the size and shape of our bodies.
Yeah. And this is not a new thing, of course. You know, sort of like the shame industrial complex started many, many centuries ago with the idea of with makeup, right? To sort of try to make you feel like you're getting old and you need to cover your wrinkles and you need to stay young. So you're going to add product to sort of appear different. So that's a sort of a standard one. The more recent one, but not that recent, is the weight loss industry. Basically, these are industries that make you feel like you have a choice, when in fact you don't really much have a choice. You don't really have a choice of growing old, or the alternative is worse. You don't really have a choice to lose weight, Diets famously do not work on the majority of people, but the diet industry makes you feel like you're the problem rather than their product. So the idea that they're sort of first manufacturing the sense that you have a choice when you don't really, and then selling you a product that doesn't work and blaming you for it not working so that you'll be a repeat customer. That's sort of the what I would call the traditional shame industrial complex, and it often has to do with bodies. I would argue that Prevagen, the sort of the supplement you're supposed to take to stay sharp, quote unquote, which is not at all scientific, is an example of that. Vagisil has a product called OMV exclamation point, which is supposed to be a deodorant for targeted at teenage girls, which first manufactures shame about their smell when they have their period, and then sells them a product to supposedly deal with the problem, probably giving them yeast infections, which would lead to them actually buying Vagisil, the other product that they sell. So it's manufacturing on the one hand, making you feel like, hey, if you just were smart and made the right choice, you could get rid of this terrible problem you have, and then selling you a product that doesn't work and making you feel like you're the problem. And it's a recurring cycle, and there's lots of examples of that.
You know that shame is often a major component of addiction prevention and then later recovery programs. How did the Just Say No campaign traffic in shame?
Yeah, I mean, so that's not exactly the profit center of a weaponized shame, but rather the power center of weaponized shame. I observed that this notion that you had a choice and you made the wrong one, just it works really well to provoke shame in people. And when you've provoked shame in people, they are silenced. They feel like they don't have the right. They don't feel lovable. They don't feel worthy. So in particular, they don't have the right to complain. A really excellent example of that is back when we had the crack epidemic, which honestly should have been seen as a public health problem like COVID, but it wasn't seen that way. It was framed as a mistake made by the people who were victim of it. And it was convenient at the time for the racist sort of policies and politics that a lot of the victims of that public health crisis were poor Black people, and so it was framed as a bad choice that was made by drug addicts, and they should stop making bad choices. It's always framed as a choice. You'll see that over time and time again in shame. When you shame somebody in a bullying and inappropriate manner, you're going to frame it as you chose wrong. And so Just Say No was exactly to that point. Just say no. It's a choice. And it was overly drastically simplifying it as if that we had, a similar thing would be like, it's a choice to get COVID. It's not a choice to get COVID. It's a public health problem. We don't choose to get sick. So it's a way, I would argue, in the cases of these kinds of policies and politics, it's a way of for us to avoid actually dealing with the problem. What we do is we blame the sufferers of the problem on their problem. That way, we, number one, don't have to solve it. We don't have to address it. And number two, we can feel like we're distancing ourselves from it, which means that we can feel like we're not going to have that problem, and our children are not going to have that problem, and it's a them problem, not an us problem.
How did you see shaming backfire in the campaigns to get everybody who was eligible vaccinated against COVID?
Well, so far I've been talking about when is shame appropriate, and just to sort of like round that out, I would say shaming is inappropriate if you're exaggerating someone's choice, if they don't have choice, and I would even say it's inappropriate if they don't have the chance to defend themselves, they don't have the staying power to be seen doing better, making a better decision. So that's I call that choice and voice. And that's a really important part of my book, is try to understand when is it appropriate to shame. But a second and very important question is, when does it work? When does shame work? Because shame could be appropriate but still not work. And I think masking is a great example of that, or vaccinations. They're very often choices that you can make. And the question of whether they have voice is contextual. Sometimes people have the opportunity to explain themselves. Sometimes people don't. The problem, of course, is that it's not just that it needs to be appropriate for it to work. It also needs to be a shared norm, for example. So you're always shaming somebody with respect to a rule, with respect to a norm, right? whether that's like don't hoard food during famine or whatever else the norm is. In this case, it's like you should take your vaccine because it will protect you and other people. But a lot of people just didn't share that norm, the underlying norm. They didn't trust, and it's not because necessarily they didn't think that vaccines worked, although some of them suspected that they didn't work, but because they had other norms that were competing and winning in their brains, which is like, I need my freedom, or I don't like needles, or whatever it is. So the problem with shaming somebody when they don't share the norm with you is that it is rightly seen, the approach, the shaming approach is rightly seen as an attack, right? It is kind of like punching somebody. It's kind of like saying, you're not worthy, you're a bad person. And even if it doesn't, even if they don't agree with the norm, it still feels really bad. So sometimes it feels bad and it convinces them to conform. But if they really don't agree with the norm, when somebody tries to shame them, they will be outraged and they will double down on their position. So my point is that when you shame somebody without checking first to see whether they agree with the underlying norm, you really run the risk of it backfiring and them sort of doubling down on their position rather than agreeing with you and conforming to the rule that you're pointing out.
Why do we sometimes feel good about shaming other people, particularly other people? I don't mean people in our daily lives. I mean people we've never met that we observe in the media or online.
Yeah, it's a really important point because, as I just pointed out, the primary goal of shame is to conform, make somebody conform to a norm. And that's, we might even think that's the only goal of shame, but it's not. The secondary goal of shame is to set an example of that person so that other people know the rules. And that's often what we're doing when we're shaming people. And that's often what we think we're doing when we're shaming people online, by the way. We're setting an example. But there's a third goal of shame, which is really much more present online, in my opinion, is that it's called perf it's performing shame. So performing shame is sort of being the police person in the room and saying, I and basically being righteous. Is in fact, it's been studied in labs by psychologists like Molly Crockett. It's been shown to give us a stimulation of our pleasure center. So we get stimulated, we get happy, we enjoy the act of shaming other people. In social media, of course, we're sort of stuck in these filter bubbles where like we're friends with like-minded folks. We typically are served, algorithmically served content that outrages us, which is not a coincidence. It's designed to do that. Then we shame the people outside our circle for their bad behavior. It often backfires because they're often not in the same norm group as we are, and they get outraged and shame us back. All of that is something that gives us pleasure center, not only for the original shame. The attempt of shaming the other people, but also when our friends pile on and agree with us and retweet us or like us or share us, those are all pleasure center stimulations for us. But I will hazard to guess that on the typical situation on social media is that it doesn't actually work in the sense that the person you're shaming doesn't conform, they don't agree with the norm, they get outraged, they double down, they disagree with us, and it instead of the shame sort of bringing the community closer and making sure everyone is protecting the community, it actually splits the community further apart.
Kathy, your mention of performative shame and really reading this whole book made me start thinking about the way it has become almost dangerous in our culture to express forgiveness for someone because doing so threatens to put us right in the same category as the person who committed the original transgression. I read a piece recently in the Washington Post, and it was about one of the guys identified in the Me Too movement, and I am not defending the behavior, but this writer said, well, maybe this has come full circle, and now this is where this person needs to be. And people wouldn't even countenance the fact that she thought it might be appropriate for him to move on with his life. And I don't have a particular position on that, but it struck me as strange that almost everyone who responded was now mad at her for expressing any kind of empathy toward this person.
Yeah, that's a really important point. It's my position that not only are we conditioned to shame other people and sort of, to jump on the shame train, if you will, on social media whenever it's presented. But it's actually changed our norm, right? So it becomes sort of an addictive thing we do in the context of social media, but it does definitely leak out onto in real life, so to speak, but also into the way we think about how to treat others. And it's really quite sad because it isn't very empathetic. Although I will caution that I don't think we really are looking to expand empathy per se. I think we're looking to sort of avoid what I call dignity violations. But one of those dignity violations, I think the crucial one in this context is, and by the way, dignity violations is a notion of Donna Hicks, who I'm a huge admirer of. She is a peace negotiator who observed that after war, people needed to deal with the dignity that had been violated before they could even negotiate terms of negotiated settlements. So I feel like the context of social media is just rife with dignity violations, and the most important one is giving the person the benefit of the doubt. We don't do that. We see somebody's mistake and we make them live it forever, you know, so that there's some kind of notion that it's sort of unforgivable and that they couldn't, even if they did really make a mistake, that they couldn't somehow grow through it. It's a n not just a problem of social media, of course. It is a sort of a problem of our society in general. I'd say that the way we punish people in prison, you know, like we always have this tough on crime waves, is also extremely punitive. I think maybe that's maybe the center of it, the punitive nature we have of punishment in general, that has sort of now leaked onto our social media. So it did come naturally to us a little bit, but it does seem to have gotten worse with the algorithmic kind of encouragement that we have.
So we give people, you know, the courts decide on a sentence for someone. They sort of pay their debt to society, but then they live with this lifelong stain of having done something bad in the past, even if they haven't committed another crime. There are, we should note, cultures all over the world that use shame sort of loudly and proudly as a way to get people to act right. But you found that some of those also have created rituals to allow people to re-enter the fold after they've been shamed for behaving badly.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I would argue that they don't use shame quite so blithely as we've been trained to do, quite so sort of impulsively. So the story that I open the book with is a story I heard about what are called the Pueblo shame clowns. And the story I got it specifically was from a Hopi sort of summer ritual where there's like a lot of very solemn rituals, but it sort of the entertainment in between the solemn rituals were these shame clouds who would, in the beginning of the first day of the festival, would sort of descend as if from the moon or from some alien place, not knowing the rules of being Hopi. And they would make all sorts of mistakes, and like they would like eat their poop and have sex in public, like all these things that were against the rules, right? So because they didn't know the rules, and then they would learn the rules, and over time and over the couple days of the festival, by the third day they knew the rules, and what they did was they became the performers of shame. So they would pull people out from in the audience who had been behaving unHopi. And there was an example of them pulling out this bootlegger who had been selling alcohol in the village, which was against the rules. The point of this wasn't to destroy him forever. The point was literally to publicly shame him in a somewhat comic way, to get him to actually change his ways. And the idea was, like the next time this ritual comes around, let's hope you've improved your behavior, and we have other people to call on and not you. And the idea is that I would call that healthy shame, because it really is set, number one, on community values, and also on conforming and asking the person to conform to this rule so that the community can stay healthy.
How does shame play into the way we decide collectively which low-income people are worthy of poverty relief?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the framing of the undeserving poor itself is shaming, right? Because it sets up this process by which a poor person will be scrutinized and looked over, and they have to sort of prove themselves to be a deserving poor person. And that threat that they could be an undeserving poor person is always, always present. That's why that shaming, that sort of inherently shaming approach we take to welfare is why we have so many work requirements and paperwork requirements and all sorts of other demeaning things that serve to be so shaming, in fact, that a lot of people who qualify for welfare don't want to go through the shaming ritual of getting it. And of course, the brunt of that suffering lands on the children who, just going back to the choice and voice thing, have absolutely no choice of in the matter of being poor, nor do they have a voice at all. So it really is the worst type of punching down. I mean, some of the motivating examples for me of writing this book were when I found out about lunch money shaming that some children were in all over the country. Actually, this is a policy in a lot of school systems, will actually stamp a child's arm with stamps saying things like "I need lunch money," and refuse ch children money, refuse them to have a lunch if their parents have run out of money for the school lunches. And so, I think a kind of a quintessential example of shaming people for something that they cannot control and have no voice over.
You learned that when you make people ashamed of poverty, rather than somehow giving them the instant tools to improve their lot in life, what happens is one of two things. Either people hide the problem, deny they are living in poverty, or they act like poverty doesn't really exist. Talk a little bit about that and why neither one ultimately is achieving what sort of the shamers hope that it will.
Yeah, and it's like it's a great example. And I want to point out that like poverty shame exists in every country that it's been studied. Probably in every single country, there's a lot of work being done about poverty shame, and this notion of the deserving and undeserving poor. But there's not every country makes it into specific policies like the United States does. So I do think that we could do a lot better. It's not that we can eradicate poverty shame altogether from poor people, but we can lighten up a little bit or a lot. But yes, you're right that poverty shame, it's and like other shame, I mean, that's kind of like the point I'm trying to make, I guess, is that poverty is a problem. People who are poor know it. They know they have a problem. They would rather not have that problem. Adding to that problem, the heap, the burden of intense shame doesn't help them solve the problem. What it does is it makes them feel like they need to hide it. So there's two ways of hiding it. One of them is to sort of withdraw from society altogether and sort of never allow people to know the extent to which they are, poor. Not inviting people to their house, not going out because they don't have the right clothes or whatever it is. So that's very bad for people because, as you can imagine, connections to other people is in fact good for you psychologically as well as a way for you to do better. The other way of hiding your poverty is to pretend you're not poor and just spend money that you don't have and get into debt, which is also a cycle that doesn't help people leave poverty. And so, putting aside the question of what economic policies should we change in order to, improve mobility in this country, which we could do a lot for that, we could simply just stop shaming poor people so much because it's not helping them.
So, if shaming people for being poor is punching down, punching up is something like asking why we allow poverty to exist in the first place?
With punching up, I think the sort of you want to think of it as holding power to account. So I'm not suggesting that we blame politicians for allowing poverty to exist, but we can absolutely hold politicians accountable for allowing poverty to get worse and for inequality to sort of get arbitrarily bad, especially if we're holding them to a standard that they already claimed they would have, right? So the quintessential punching up is if a politician claims that they're going to do something to alleviate inequality or alleviate poverty, and they get into office and they don't do that, then you shame them for not doing that on behalf of people in poverty.
Something that we should all think about, I guess, Kathy, before we jump on the bandwagon to shame some other person, particularly some person that we don't know personally, is to make sure that we're getting the whole truth, right? You recall here the story of the video that many people saw of white kids in MAGA hats seeming to harass this elderly Native American man at the Lincoln Memorial a couple of years ago. That brief clip went everywhere. People condemned it. It struck us as horrifying. But there's more to the story that didn't circulate.
I mean, yeah. And of course, I was deep into my shame research at the time. I remember someone I encountered said, "I just wanted to punch that kid in the face." And I was like, wow, we are really triggered to shame people. And I just want to make it clear that I blame the tech companies for doing this. I am not trying to punch down at every single person who retweeted that video. I am trying to punch up at the tech companies that have actually sort of formed this interest we have in punching at folks and shaming them. This is an addiction we have. And for me, of course, I will just say from my perspective as the mother of three white boys, like, I didn't see it. I looked at the video. I was like, he looks really awkward and uncomfortable. That I interpreted it as like, this is an uncomfortable person. I didn't see what it was that was offensive. And when we saw the larger context and saw that he was standing there and this the Native drummer walked up to him, it was just like, what did he actually do that people were so offended by? I didn't even get it. But I think you're right, and I'm glad that you brought up this notion of getting the whole story, because really what I want to expand what I mean by voice, because I think that before we shame somebody, we need to hear their side of the story. It's kind of a due process constitutional notion that we have in this country. It's a good principle that we somehow have lost sight of in social media. We want to hear them defend themselves. And of course, to your other point, if they're somebody we don't know and never will know, it's just not right, because we'll never see them conform. We'll never welcome them back into the community and say, you have redeemed yourself. So it is sort of like by construction, we're shaming them and never hearing from them again. And just kind of like, that will be our final parting thought, is that they are unworthy. And that's just not an appropriate approach to interacting with other folks.
How do we decide, Kathy, how much grace to extend or not to extend to folks who are not sort of keeping up with changing social and cultural norms? I'm thinking of certainly people who are non-binary and use non-binary pronouns have come in for a lot more abuse and shame than the people who are misidentifying them. On the other hand, sometimes people misidentify and it truly is a mistake or just something they're not educated about. What do we do with that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I'm going to give you two examples which are not that subtle, but I do want to acknowledge that there is subtlety in between these two examples. But so the first one I think is a great example is the sort of pronoun, like state your pronouns before starting in a conversation or have a name tag with your pronouns or whatever. I know a lot about this conversation through my children. And I'm totally on board with it. But I also know a lot of people who just miss that conversation. They're not on Twitter. They are not on social media. They are in a different generation and they do not get it. And they are shamed by people when they don't get it. And it doesn't help. Shame doesn't help. Ignorance is sometimes a really good excuse for not understanding what the rules are. And by the way, I will add that, like, social media, I don't blame the people who think that everyone should know about non-binary pronouns, because social media has this ability to make us feel like we're making progress. We're making social progress. Our norms are changing for the better. But that feeling that we get that we've made progress comes from the fact that we are in a very small part of the society. We're in a little bubble on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever it is. So inside our bubble, yes, we've had that conversation, and we've made that progress. But the people outside that bubble weren't even in that conversation. They don't know what we're talking about. They don't know the new language that we've invented. And again, so it's not really anybody's fault in particular, but our approach of shaming people who miss the conversation, who miss the memo, it does actually doesn't help in the sense that those are people that are potential allies, and when we call them ignorant instead of explain what they missed, they don't actually become allies. That's the first example where it's like ignorance because you missed a conversation. The other example, though, which might look superficially like a similar issue, is not, which is people who are just simply in denial about something, right? Where they're not missing the conversation, but they don't want to have the conversation. And I would sort of reference the notion of white shame, like the fact that we have governments passing rules that we're not that some teachers are not allowed to talk about the history of slavery, because it makes white kids feel uncomfortable. I mean, that's just simply denial of historical facts. It's not that they've missed the conversation about racism. It's that they don't want to have the conversation about racism because they're in the denial stage of shame rather than willing to do the reckoning that I talked about in the context of apologies. Like, we have to do a reckoning as a society, as white people in a society that has that found found was founded on slavery. If we're not willing to do that work, that's denial. That's not missing a conversation. That's not ignorance as an excuse. That's denial as a strategy.
Author Cathy O'Neill is a contributor to Bloomberg Opinion. She launched the LEAD program for data journalism at Columbia University and recently founded an algorithmic auditing company. Her book is called The Shame Machine: Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation? Cathy, this has been really interesting. Thanks for making time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. Really appreciated it.
You can like our page on Facebook. We are on Twitter at KERA Think, and you can subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.